everyone to this Tarnas-Wajewski lecture. I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. James Hegarty from the Department of Theological and Religious Studies at the University of Wales in Cardiff. James has been doing research on the Mahabharata and narrative traditions of South Asia for a number of years now. He's published some papers on it, and he's got a book. I'm not sure if it's out yet, but it's coming out on called Religion, Narrative, and Public Imagination, which is mainly about the epic, I believe. Yes. So, without more ado, I'll hand you over to James. Thank you. Oh, sorry, the title of James's talk this afternoon is Telling the World, Exploring the Cultural and Intellectual Agenda of the Sanskrit Mahabharata.
So, good afternoon, everyone. Yes, I'm going to talk about the Mahabharata today. I'll just start then. So, if the Mahabharata were a building, I think its scale would be sort of hard to imagine. It would be as much a city as a single sort of construction, and you'd have kind of small annexes jostling vast halls and tiny passageways connecting every part of the building to every other part. I think people would queue to gain entry to it. I think you'd find backpackers and families posing sort of proudly in front of it recording the moment that they were fortunate enough to visit it. But I'm rather sad that old texts lead often slightly less glamorous existences than old buildings. And when scanning the kind of globally shared bookshelf, the eye tends to sort of skip over works in abstruse ancient Indian languages that are about four times the length of the Bible. Now, we know that the Mahabharata is loved by countless numbers of adults and children in South Asia, but rarely in Sanskrit. It's known through retellings and reworkings of its content in vernacular literature, local performance traditions, comic books, and television programs. It's loved as a great story, as a source of wisdom, and modern India itself, as you all know, is Bharat, after the founder of the lineage whose story is told in the Mahabharata. So this lecture draws upon my studies of that great text. I'm going to explore the vastness of the Mahabharata with a view to saying a few things about its design. I'm going to consider those who enjoyed visiting it and why, changing it, in fact, in many cases. And my research is something of a labour of love. I would like many more people to visit the Sanskrit Mahabharata and enjoy its great halls and less visited corners. But I have only 50 minutes, so I'm going to restrict myself to a brief demonstration of certain basic features of the Mahabharata and its reception. So I'm going to show, one, that the Mahabharata sought to integrate new religious ideologies into the Brahminical mainstream. A mainstream that I should add, that I suspect, I believe but cannot prove, that should have a sort of acronym, CP, that it was largely making it up as it went along. I secondly want to show that the Mahabharata was largely successful in establishing its view of an aboriginally Brahminical South Asia, both in terms of its past and its physical and metaphysical extent, but that equally its moral and practical aporia were much exploited by subsequent interpreters of the text. So I'm going to explore the ways in which the Mahabharata managed to walk a fine line between a sort of all-singing, all-dancing Brahminical triumphalism, and a rich sense of the irresolvable questions and intractable difficulties of human existence. It's the balance of the dogmatic and the interrogative that I'm going to argue constitutes the powerful appeal of this text to generations of South Asians. My first point of the integration of new religious ideologies and the construction of a rich sense of past and place is best demonstrated when you have this amount of time, through a case study. And I think a certain truculent mongoose is going to serve us well in this regard. So I'm now going to talk about this odd little episode with a mongoose. So our mongoose appears towards the end of the Mahabharata, after the great and destructive battle at its heart, and subsequent to the victorious King Yudhishthira's consolation by his dying grandfather Bhishma. At this point in the Mahabharata, King Yudhishthira has been encouraged to perform a grand sacrifice as a means of expiating the sins of battle and of underscoring his rule over the known world. And this sacrifice is known as the Ashwamedha, or horse sacrifice. And we're going to pick up the tale during the second stage of Yudhishthira's Ashwamedha when the culminatory three-day rite is drawing to a close. And King Yudhishthira stands supreme before the assembled dignitaries, with his head showered with flowers. And it is at this point that the mongoose appears. He's described as having a golden flank, Rukma Barshwa, and he wastes no time in addressing King Yudhishthira in a voice that is like thunder and lightning, and his words are challenging. O lords of men, this your sacrifice is not equal, natulya, to a handful of barley given by a liberal inhabitant of the field of Kuru who practices the discipline of gleaning, the Unchavruti. The mongoose calls into question the value of the Ashwamedha by means of comparing it to the practice of gleaning, living by gathering leftover grains and other foodstuffs. He asserts that gleaners possess more merit than those who engage in costly and harmful sacrifices. He provides further evidence for his case by narrating how he came to have a golden flank. The mongoose states that his miraculous transformation occurred when he ate a few leftover grains of barley. These grains had fallen to the floor as a Brahmin, despite the fact that it meant death for both himself and his family, gave barley to a voracious guest. The guest, pleased with the selflessness of the Brahmin, reveals himself to be the god Dharma, congratulates the Brahmin, and emphasizes the power of the giving of gifts. He also lists kings of the past who have prospered as a consequence of selfless gift-giving and who have foundered as a result of showy public sacrifices. After this account, the Brahmin, his wife, his sons, and their wives all depart for heaven. So having completed this narration, the mongoose suggests that given his other flank has not turned to gold during the Ashwamedha of King Yudhishthira, that the rite is something of a dismal failure. So what do we make of this kind of bold intervention? Given where we are in the Mahabharata, at the critical point of King Yudhishthira's acceptance of his role as king and of his part in the horrific battle that stands at the heart of the text, which is a battle that cost the lives of most of his extended family and indeed his own sons, the mongoose's words are potentially devastating. All the more so for their emphasis on the inhabitants of Kurukshetra, or the field of Kuru, for it's precisely here that the great battle was fought and won at such a terrible cost. More than this, at the very outset of the war, on the eve of the battle, the entire known world has been sketched out in rich and expansive detail in the Bhumi Parva of the Bhishma Parva and elsewhere. Kurukshetra, at this point in our narrative, is a temporal and a physical focal point. It's in this heightened context that the mongoose calls into question the grand Vedic rites and their value. He emphasizes the importance of intention, of simplicity, and of the avoidance of harm to all living creatures, ahimsa, and the word is used. And in so doing, he calls into question not just Vedic sacrifice, but the act of war. The idea of non-harm sits at the heart of not just certain forms of Hindu tradition, it's the first restraint in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, for example, but it's also central, of course, to Buddhist and Jain ideologies, although gleaning itself is considered problematic for both traditions. We should also keep in mind that the Ashwamedha is a rite of royal consecration. This means that the mongoose is questioning not just the religious, but also the political establishment. He is doing so in terms that recall a wide variety of challenging new strains of thought in early South Asia. We should also remember that this is a story about the past, even for its audiences of the immediately pre-Common Era. This allows us to see that certain radical religious ideologies are here being brought into direct conflict with the Vedic religio-political establishment. We don't really have evidence for ideas of non-harm or retirement to a simple sort of forest existence until the time of the Upanishads or that of the early Buddhists and Jains. This is a long time after the events told of in the Mahabharata. The authors of the Mahabharata are guilty of a certain degree of deliberate anachronism here. The story of the defiant and critical mongoose allows for the staging of a religious debate by narrative means. The drama of the mongoose's intervention is combined with a story in which the god of religious law himself, Dharma, offers a historical narrative in which great kings of the past prosper as a consequence of their acceptance of radical new religious values. So in this way, new religious ideologies are naturalized, Brahminicized, and in that context, and that context alone, emphasized as superior. All this by means of their insertion in the significant past, their staging in the past. And in our story, this encompasses both the time of the unfolding of the main plot of the Mahabharata in the aftermath of the war, and the times before this, the remote past of former kings. All of this as a consequence of the interruption of one boldly critical mongoose. But the debate is a bit more complicated than just that. for a number of reasons. First of these is that it's not just the mongoose that advocates the superiority of the selfless gift and the absence of harm. The lesson is reinforced by one of the narrators of the Mahabharata itself, Vaishampayana, who is a pupil of the putative author of the Mahabharata, at least as the story would have it, Krishnadvaipayana Vyasa. Vaishampayana is narrating the Mahabharata to the grand nephew of King Yudhishthira, one King Janamejaya. And having told the strange and wonderful Ashcharya tale of the mongoose, Vaishampayana states, "O conqueror of distant fortresses, I have told you all about the strange and extraordinary incident at that great sacrifice, the horse sacrifice. Do not somehow retain any pride, O king, at what is achieved by sacrifice. For millions and millions of sages have gone to heaven by means of gleaning alone. The freedom from malice to all creatures, satisfaction with one's lot and one's moral rectitude, self-restraint, truthfulness, and the giving of gifts, all are thought to be equal to the sacrifice." Now, in this way, as well as integrating the way of gleaning and non-harm in the main plot and subsidiary narratives of the Mahabharata, which by their very antiquity are conveniently free of Buddhists and Jains, the text, I don't mean of the text itself, but of the narrative world it sets up, the text also allows these ideologies and practices to be reinforced and subtly altered by one of the internal narrators of the text. The context of narration also stands somewhat nearer to the present of the Mahabharata's various audiences, both ancient and modern, in that it comes after the events of the Mahabharata and after the rule of Yudhishthira's nephew and successor, King Parikshit, the father of King Janamejaya. In fact, in the Mahabharata and certain Puranas, we find that on occasion Janamejaya and his father are amongst the first kings of the Kali Yuga, the present and most debased age of humankind. We should also note that the message is changed in Vaishampayana's summary. Vaishampayana finishes his final exhortation to Janamejaya by stating that these practices are the equal summum of sacrificial activity. That's rather different to that the message of our truculent mongoose. That isn't what he said, natulya. That was what he said, they are not equal. So Vaishampayana reinforces, but also mildly subverts, the teaching of the mongoose. And all of that is made possible by the text's complex range of storytelling and story-hearing activities. But the matter doesn't end there. Sorry, it's going to sort of layer up a little. King Janamejaya does not accept the exhortation of Vaishampayana. He demurs. He says, I'm not sure. Vaishampayana has to tell a further tale of the paramount Vedic god Indra and his discussion with the Rutviks, Vedic ritual specialists. In this tale, a dispute arises at a sacrifice being performed by Indra as to the value of animal offerings. The assembled beings look to King Vasu of Chedi to resolve the matter, but he fails to do so and, as a result, is cast into hell. This story thus pushes the debate back into the mouth of one of the leading Vedic deities, Indra, the divine king. Now, it's not a Vedic narrative. It's Vedish, at best. It further shows the dangers to a king from the neighbouring region of Chedi that fails to resolve such an issue with due care. In this way, the tale connects a contemporary debate to a Vedic notable and in turn connects him to a relatively local king. This may also have had an attendant regionalist agenda of denigrating the Chedis, even as the tale of the mongoose valorised the Brahmins of the land of Kuru. In fact, Vaishampayana makes the religiously revisionist agenda of the tale absolutely clear when he asserts, "O Bharata, Brahmins, Kshatriya, Vaishyas and Shudras who turn to the way of gleaning and who are purified in the fire of the obligatory gift, go to heaven." Now there's another twist, I'm sorry. It goes on. Subsequent to the arrival of our caste of divine notables, regional kings and impoverished Brahmins, and the questions of King Janamejaya, who can't quite believe that sacrifice is entirely pointless, we find that our mongoose is not entirely what he seems, nor is he acting entirely of his own volition. We're told that our mongoose is, in fact, also the god Dharma, the god of religious law, who had in former times deliberately spoilt the milk being used by a Brahmin sage by the name of Jamadagni, who was completing a shraddha, an offering to his ancestors. Dharma's motivation is playful, if dangerous. He wishes to see if he will be cursed by the famously kind of hot-headed Jamadagni, who is of that famous Brahmin lineage, the Bhagavas. In fact, it is the ancestors of Jamadagni, I mean, they're the ones who got the spoiled milk, who do the cursing. They condemn Krodha to the form of a mongoose. This is Krodha Dharma at this point. The condition of release from the curse is rather odd. Dharma will only be restored to his divine form when he insults Dharma. And this happens in the following way. Having derided the son of Dharma with the accusation of the handful of barley, anger was released from his curse because Dharma was Yudhishthira. So by means of this deus ex machina of the curse, the mongoose's challenge to Yudhishthira's Ashwamedha is neutralized. It's achieved in two ways. Firstly, the mongoose is obliged to insult the sacrifice. Secondly, the Ashwamedha, and perhaps by extension sacrificial activity in general, is founded upon Yudhishthira's semi-divine identity as the son of Dharma. He was the god-fathered Dharma upon his mother Kunti. And that's expressed in the Sanskrit by means of a total identification of father and son. Yudhishthira is Dharma. Yudhishthira is the law. Despite the fact that subsequent kings cannot claim such an illustrious father, this must be a comforting sentiment for Janamajaya's descendants. It's also worth noting that with the restitution of the sacrifice comes an implicit defense of the act of war, which is itself an act conceived of in sacrificial terms throughout the Mahabharata. Just a fair example would be Karna, when Duryodhana says, Karna and I have laid out the battle ritual, having made Yudhishthira the sacrificial offering. We too are consecrated, O bull of the Bharata. It's just to give you a kind of idea of the sort of thing you hear all the time. We should also bear in mind that Jamadagni is the ancestor of another of the heroes of the Mahabharata within the text. For as well as Vaishampayana's narration of the Mahabharata to King Janamejaya, we are told that a bard by the name of Ugrashravas, who attended Vaishampayana's narration, repeated it to a group of Brahmins headed by one Shaunaka, a descendant of Jamadagni, and thus also a Bhagava. So the story of the curse of the mongoose brings together the power of this particular descent group of Brahmins, for it's they that do the cursing, the divine identity of King Yudhishthira, who's the great-great uncle of King Janamejaya, his power as the son of Dharma. All of this is brought together to rescue the Vedic sacrifice from the religiously and perhaps socially revolutionary sentiments of the mongoose. But even as it does this, it establishes the power, effectiveness, and history of tapas, and in particular the Unsha mode, the way of gleaning. So the story of the mongoose is universally attested amongst the manuscripts of the Ashwamedika Paravan that survived to us. It's mentioned in the list of books in the first book of the Mahabharata, and an 11th century epitome of the Mahabharata, the Bharata Manjari of Kshemendra, also provides an account of the list, listing it as the Nakula Upakyana, the subtale of the mongoose. The story of the mongoose is also one of the very clear points of agreement between the Mahabharata's Ashwamedika Parva and a competing version of the text. This is known as the Jaimaniya Ashwamedika Parva. Jaimini is, in the Mahabharata, like Vaishampayana, a pupil of Vyasa. The Jaimaniya Ashwamedika Parva is dated to around the 12th century and purports to be a part of Jaimini's version of the Mahabharata. Now, these two works differ widely in their content. We haven't found any more of Jaimini's Mahabharata than this Ashwamedika Parva, and it's under question whether any more existed. They're broadly similar in the way that they treat our country mongoose, but there are some important differences. Where the Mahabharata's Ashwamedika Parva required that the mongoose insult Dharma, the Jaimini text states that the mongoose must insult Dharma in the presence of Krishna. And if we move from this kind of seemingly rather minor detail to the close of the tale in the Jaimini version, we find that it has considerable ripple effects. Lord Krishna, Hari, Lord of the universe, wielder of the conch shell, the discus and the mace, protected the sacrifice till the end. After guarding the sacrifice, the strong-armed one was always worshipped by the Pandavas. He stayed at the city for many days, enjoying himself. So Jaimini transforms the tale from one that underscores the authoritative status of King Yudhishthira as Dharma to one that depicts Krishna as the defender of the Vedic sacrifice and as Lord of the universe. It's not an idea that's alien to the Mahabharata, but it's not one that's brought to the fore at this juncture of the text. So we're kind of in a position, and I can't do any more today because I do want to talk about the reception of the Mahabharata, but we are in a position to begin to see how every interest, every social institution is transformed into the Mahabharata, into story. And these narratives allow old and new ideas to enter into a form of debate that hangs much more on narrative detail than explicit argument. The country mongoose also shows how ideas, some of which are perhaps slightly more from below and by no means wholly Brahminical, are integrated and refuted by means of storytelling and hearing activity. And these stories, with their range of internal audiences, also provide all sorts of prompts to readers and hearers outside of the Mahabharata, which I can't discuss today. The tale of the mongoose captures the questioning, the apologetic, and the triumphalist capacities of the Mahabharata, including, in this instance, the secondary reworking of the tale. And it evinces a complex use of past and place. And this gives us something of a clue to the wider capacities and purposes of the Mahabharata. And it is to these that I'll turn now. So the reception of the Mahabharata. Now, this is such a vast topic that I can't do more than provide a few case studies today. And those case studies will be literary and epigraphical. Now, I think we're beginning to be able to see, at least from the case study, that the Mahabharata was a sort of imaginative intervention of a quite aggressive and innovative type. But we can only really corroborate impact by looking, and I don't mean to use that word in the present, if you're a British academic, the word impact is not a favoured one, but anyway, never mind, I've used it now. We can only begin to corroborate its impact by a broader consideration of the early South Asian textual and epigraphical record. So the corpus is hopelessly large. So my examples are illustrative only today. I'll take up a few Guptan inscriptions first of all. The heroes of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana were an important part of Guptan self-presentation, demonstrated, for example, by the Supya pillar inscription of Skandagupta, dated to 460-461 CE, in which we find the following. The prosperous Skandagupta, the Maharaja who resembled a Chakravartin in strength and valour, Rama in righteous conduct, and Yudhishthira in truthfulness, conduct, and self-control, Satya Ajara Vinaya. It's also attested, the Mahabharata, in late Guptan inscriptions, such as the Iran pillar inscription of Bahanagupta, 510-511 CE. This text includes a description of the king as the equal of Bharata, an epithet of Arjuna, and states that, it does. The kingship and knowledge of the Shastras, which was likely to have included the Mahabharata, The fact that these are intertwined is clear in further Guptan inscriptions, such as the Allahabad pillar inscription of Samudragupta, which is undated, inscribed on an Ashokan pillar edict, which emphasizes the necessity for a king to be aware of the Shastras and the enclosing structure of the Dharma. And although we don't find the term Bharatavarsha, the Mahabharata's favourite designation for the expanse of something that approximates South Asia, the text is very concerned to demonstrate the great extent of Guptan conquests and uses the geographical designations Aryavarta and Dakshinapata for North and South India, respectively. It contains a very long list of the conquests of peoples that is strongly reminiscent of such lists that we find in the Mahabharata, and particularly in its second book, the Sabhaparva, which I give as follows. The son of the Punisher of Bhaga conquered the direction beloved of the Lord of Wealth, that's Arjuna, Bhima the east, Sahadeva the south, Nakula the west, while Yudhishthira, King Dharma, inhabited Gandhavaprastha. So Samudragupta in this very inscription is described as having achieved the conquest of the whole world, Nikula Bhuvana. And it appears that both the imperial agenda and the key characters of the Mahabharata are reflected in these triumphal inscriptions of the Guptas. But we find another picture in the donative inscriptions. Copper plate, mostly. We find the following exhortation, which is normally combined with a quotation from the Mahabharata as to the consequence for a king who fails to honour a land grant in perpetuity. Carefully preserve the land that has already been given to the twice-born by Yudhishthira, the best of landowners. Preservation is more meritorious than grant of land. As well as emphasizing the virtue of the doni rather than the donor, this shloka calls to mind the culmination of the Ashwamedha in the Ashwamedhika Parva, where we found our mongoose, of the Mahabharata. And I translate. Then Yudhishthira gave to those present in the sacrificial enclosure, as decreed, 1,000 crores of gold coins, and to Vyasa, the earth. And that's the container of wealth, the Vasundhara. Having accepted the earth, the son of Satyavati, Vyasa, said to that king, the best of the Bharatas, Yudhishthira, who is Dharma himself, O first among kings, you, sir, will be entrusted with this earth. Give to me its equivalent in gold, because Brahmins pursue wealth. After some negotiation, Yudhishthira accepts the earth from Krishna Dwaipayana Vyasa and offers the assembled Brahmins three times the stipulated fee for the Ashwamedha. Now, while the precise shlokas referred to in the Gupta land grants are difficult to track down, the evocation of the events of the Mahabharata is quite clear. This demonstrates that as well as functioning as a resource for sort of self-aggrandizing comparisons and for understandings of, you know, the nature and extent of conquest in this more flamboyant eulogistic material, the Mahabharata is still informing understandings of the events of the significant past in a slightly more prosaic fashion. The events of the Mahabharata, as well as the authority of its more didactic statements, inform the Guptan legal framework, at least in the matter of land grants to Brahmins. The Guptans situate themselves in a line of Brahmin-Kshatriya reciprocity that established itself most clearly, at least in ideal typical terms, in the aftermath of the Bharata War. In so doing, they implicitly suggest that their achievements are of the scale of the world-conquering King Yudhishthira. But we find much more direct references in later epigraphy. The Sendrakas, who first appear as feudatories of the Rashtrakutas and Kadambas, and later of the Chalukyas, and whose period of inscriptional activity dates from the 6th to the close of the 7th century, are fond of direct comparisons to the heroes of the Mahabharata. They love the Mahabharata. The Kasare plates of Alashakti, dated to about 653 CE, include a rich set of punning comparisons between the Sendraka and the Pandava monarch. The king Alashakti, who on earth bears resemblance to Yudhishthira because his fortune is governed by the Brahmanas. He honours the elders and is always at the head and ready because his mind is purified by righteous deeds, even as Yudhishthira's was by the deeds of Arjuna, because he is pious-minded and is followed by an excellent army, as Yudhishthira was. Dharma himself, accompanied by the noble Bhimasena, because his gifts are always shared by the Brahmanas, together with the gods, even as Yudhishthira's person was honoured by Sahadeva and his gifts shared by all, because his family is friendly and untarnished, even as Yudhishthira's brother, Nakula, exterminated his foes. I'm a little odd, the comparison, but anyway. What it does illustrate minimally is a lively awareness of the deeds of the Pandavas, as well as recording the somewhat sort of overreaching self-representation of a minor dynast. More than this, the reference to the Pandava brothers in toto and the reference to the conquering activities of Bhima, Arjuna, Nakula, and Sahadeva evoke the expansive geographical vision of the Mahabharata as it is established in the Sabha and later on in the Bhumi Parvas and elsewhere in the text. As well as this, Yudhishthira remains the model of voluntary submission to Brahmins. In this way, we can see that the Pandava brothers were evoked as a sort of politically adroit sort of expression of the realities of minor dynasts, such as the Sendrakas, who contended with a complex system of regional affiliations, both to superiors and subordinates, and Brahminical interest groups. And here, the relationship between conquering brothers was apposite, and the part of the history itself, valuable. The inscriptions of the early Chalukyas of the Gujarat also mention characters from the Mahabharata. An inscription of the Chalukya vassals, the dynasty of Harishchandra from the area of Nashik in Maharashtra, dated about 710-711 CE, mentions the senior Pandava brothers and is also noteworthy because it refers to the Mahabharata as a text. Bhogashakti is described as someone who is proficient in understanding the import and principles of the Bharata, the Ramayana, and the science of politics. This shows that the Mahabharata has established itself as a sort of stereotyped feature of the education of kings. Indeed, by the close of the first millennium, amongst the Kalachuris of Tripuri, we find rich and sustained engagements with the detail of the Mahabharata. The Bilhari stone inscriptions of Yuvaraja Deva II, dated to 975 CE, are a tour de force of descriptive excess, and they plunge us right into the action of the Mahabharata. Seeing him, Drona, whose strong arm was skillful in wielding the bow, and who, with his many powerful arrows, exterminated the Pandava army. Even that son of Dharma, who was honoured for veracity, swerved from the truth when he lost all hope of defeating the enemy. Drona. Furthermore, the Chalukyas are said to descend from Drona in verse 33 of the same text. While Yuvaraja Deva II himself has his descent traced from another character in the Mahabharata, Arjuna Gartavirya. It's clear that the Mahabharata is providing a rich range of resources for the tracing of descent, for the patterns of conquest, and for the range of moral and practical qualities to be associated with kingship. And establishing itself as a text, as a feature of royal education. And the later inscriptions show a richer and more detailed engagement with the events of the Mahabharata and a concern to compare and even integrate the significant past of the Pandavas with their own activities and those of their ancestors. I mean, I don't think there can be really any doubt of the enduring significance of the Mahabharata in royal self-presentation in first millennium South Asia. Moving to literary culture, it's and this is such a vast field, and I know that in my abstract I promised you talk of some Kashmiri texts. In fact, I promised you the world. I think it should have been Telling the World. Was a bold title. I promised you some Kashmiri material, which I'm not going to discuss today. I've just got to put up my hands. There is no time. I will perhaps mention it in passing towards the end if I have a little bit of time. But instead, I'm going to talk about, I did mention Kerala, and I'm going to talk about something that is debatably Kerala, the works of the playwright Bhasa, because it's there that we find some of the richest engagements with the Mahabharata. Now, there's considerable controversy over Bhasa and his date and his very existence. Most recently, Herman Tekin has argued that Bhasa is not an individual at all and that his putative works are in fact anonymous compositions belonging to the Keralan dramatic repertory of about the 7th century CE. A.K. Warder, for example, dated him much earlier than that, I think before about 2nd century CE. So, I mean, there's a huge disparity. I would say that... I'm not in a position to rule on that. But whatever their precise date, our kind of perhaps composite Bhasa engagement with the Mahabharata is sustained. And there are six plays attributed to him about the Mahabharata or that take up features of the plot of the text. And he tends to emphasize ambivalent events in the tale. And it is in the Urubanga that this tendency is most fully expressed. And it is to this text that I'm going to turn now. The Urubanga, or the Breaking of the Thighs, is a one-act play that takes up the mace duel between Bhima and Duryodhana at the close of the Shalya Parva of the Mahabharata. This wonderful moment where finally Bhima, who had promised to smash the thigh of Duryodhana in the earlier on in the text when they lost everything in the game of dice, now gets his moment to come and have at Duryodhana. And it marks the end of the formal part of the war, and it precedes the brutal events of the night attack when in the Saptika Parva, where Ashwathaman slaughters the remaining forces of the Pandavas and their children. Not a cheery tale, as you all know. Bhasa's text, even in the prologue, exhibits a very clear consciousness of the horrors of the Mahabharata war. And I quote... "Your Honour, why do these men roam about testing each other's valour, their bodies marked by the tusks of wild elephants, and limbs scarred by sword and axe? Is it for heaven that they pour out their bodies' libation on the altar of war?" Now, the prologue is oddly truncated for a Sanskrit drama, and neither the play or the author is named in it. And the main action commences with three unnamed soldiers wandering across Kurukshetra. And the emphasis on the horror of war is unremitting and reminiscent of the Striparva of the Mahabharata, which you've ever looked at is quite sort of vile and shocking, with wives cradling the severed heads of their husbands, and it's a very moving and dark text. And we find that sort of horror evoked here. "Birds pepper the field of battle, their beaks wet with flesh. Headless corpses twitch from the habit of life." And there's a certain aestheticization of death as well. "Their fearless, upturned faces, like a silent lotus lake, made to bloom by the sun of valour shining in the sky of war. For stalks, I see swords bearing buds of diadems. For filaments, frowns. For petals, lips. For bees, those sightless eyes." Bhasa here takes up, amongst other things, the favoured Indian dramatic figure of the brow and the bee. I should say this is Edwin Garau's translation, which is just lovely. So this is the one portion of the text where I am not providing the translations because I'm greatly admiring of this particular. I admire this translation very much. But Bahasa here takes up this favourite Indian dramatic figure of the brow and the bee. And in other contexts, these form the stock in trade of rather more delicate descriptions of heroes and heroines. So perhaps the finest example of that sort of thing is to be found in Kalidasa's Shakuntala. And, here we go. Shakuntala, in confusion. It's difficult to read this out. Aye! You know, it's hard to, in serious, grave academic context, make a sort of squeal. But there we are. That's my best. The best I can do for you. Disturbed by my watering, a bee has flown out of the jasmine into my face. She shows every sign of being attacked by a bee. The king, looking longingly, wonderful! Even this threat enhances her charm. I shouldn't put it in such a pompous tone, should I, either? But I can't help it. It seems to sort of be appropriate. Where the bee flies, there fly her eyes. Beneath her lovely knitted brows, she darts an ardent glance, inspired by fear. Mere practice, for on other days, such looks shall match a lover's gaze in pure desire. Now, the Urubanga transforms this popular trope, the bee in the brow, into a meditation on the death of the warrior. And in so doing, Bahasa emphasises the moral ambivalence of both the battlefield and his glorification of it. And this is reinforced when Bahasa employs a simile that takes up the degeneration of text. The battlefield is heaped with dead horses, elephants, kings and men, like a wormy manuscript whose characters are corrupt. This is a comparison that he returns to later in the Urubanga. Ashwatthaman speaks, "Listen, with a wave of my sword, I will rid you of Krishna and all the sons of Pandu. I will throw them away like a manuscript of blotted characters." The simile of these degenerating texts lends a certain sort of self-referentiality to Bahasa's work. Even as corpses rot and as heroes die, so too does the written word degenerate and disappear. The numbing impact of his emphasis on the visual dimensions of death by violence and the inevitability of the degeneration and loss of life, of both life and text, create a distancing effect. Unlike, for example, Buddhist meditation manuals, which focus on the prison of the physical body, here it is the entire ambit of social and textual life that is presented at its most squalid and problematic. As well as these aesthetic, even ascetic tendencies, at a more basic level, Bahasa clearly has a passion for the underdog. This is made particularly clear in his use of the churning of the ocean myth, where the gods and the demons churn for the fundaments of social life, much told in the Mahabharata, but also in Puranic texts and elsewhere. Duryodhana, after he has been unfairly struck and defeated by Bhima, is described as follows. He lies like Vasuki in the primal sea, exhausted, shedding his skin after churning the ambrosia, of no use to god or demon. Here Bahasa refocuses attention upon the snake of the Amrutamanthana story, the churning. However, for Bahasa, the snake is an exploited and disregarded figure. He thus introduces a moral ambivalence into the churning narrative that is entirely absent from its telling, at least in the Adi Bharava of the Mahabharata and later Puranic versions. This could be read on a number of levels. It helps to rehabilitate Duryodhana and cast him in a new and more noble light. It might be a reference to the exploitation of human agents fated to die as a consequence of the unburdening of the earth, which is the cosmic justification of the Mahabharata war. Or it might rather be a more straightforward plea for the cosmically and socially exploited. Whatever the case, it is clear that Bahasa is far from unequivocal in his view of the Pandavas. The sheer fact that the Pandavas say so little in this drama allows the spotlight to shine on Duryodhana. The pathetic scene of Duryodhana's encounter with his young son as he dies, as he lies dying on the battlefield, is especially moving in this regard. You might need tissues. Duryodhana speaks. Affection for him consumes my heart, even in my misery. Durjaya, the son. Papa, I want to sit in your lap. I'm going to make it sound ridiculous, sorry. He climbs. Duryodhana restraining him. Durjaya, Durjaya, my boy, be careful. This young moon of my heart's joy, who has so often delighted my sight, assumes in my misfortune the strange shape of a scorching fire. Durjaya, why won't you let me sit in your lap? Duryodhana, sit somewhere else. This too familiar place, henceforth, is not for you. We're in a position to see now the extent to which Bahasa plumbs the pathos, when I read it, the bathos, of the death of Duryodhana and the wider loss of life in Kurukshetra. The play ends as abruptly as it starts and promises only the night attack, told in the Sattvika Parva, as I mentioned. Balarama, the most vocal critic of the Pandavas at this point in the play, speaks the benediction. May the king protect the earth, his enemies appeased. This suggests a rather bleak closing irony. On one level, the protection of the earth is precisely what the Mahabharata war achieves. The earth is rid of its fractious and problematic warrior class. Yet Bahasa seems to focus far more on the human cost of war and the limits of human achievement. Bahasa dwells on the ambivalences and the moral and practical aporia in the Mahabharata in order to stimulate emotional and aesthetic response, of course. But he also points to the complexity of human action and the conundrums of divine and cosmic constraint. Now, this is a long way from the triumphal evocation of the Mahabharata that we saw in the royal inscriptions. But, as anyone who's read the Mahabharata knows, it's not so far removed from the text itself. So we're in a position to see two broad trends in the reception of the Mahabharata. The one triumphal, the other interrogative. And if I had talked about the Kashmiri materials, I would have shown how the triumphal was reflected in the Nilamata Purana and the interrogative again in the Rajatarangini of Kalhana. Now, I've barely scratched the surface of the material available to us, but I think it is clear already that the Mahabharata does tell the world in every sense of that phrase. It provides a capacious vision of past and place and a series of new teachings on both the challenges and the correct conduct of human existence. From a tissue of more or less obscure Vedic notables, it fashioned a unified, Brahminically inflected history of mankind. From a range of geo and cosmographical speculations, it fashioned a vision of the physical and metaphysical extent of both South Asia and the known and unknown worlds beyond it. And this was, I think you should recall, a South Asia that had only really begun to be delineated by the conquests of Ashoka. And all of this is integrated and manipulated by means of an extraordinarily sophisticated use of narrative as a form for both debate and propaganda. It's also clear that this vision of past and place in the Mahabharata was considered to be widely persuasive, where the inscriptional material built on the triumphalism of the Mahabharata and its visions of world conquest. Bahasa and many others use the text to explore the complexities and vagaries of human existence. It's clear then that the Mahabharata, for all its bluster, all its frequent claims of its great power, is able to make good on so many of these claims with regard to its own significance. And we're also in a position to see that the text had an enduring impact on forms of royal and Brahminical self-presentation, as well as the questioning and the unpicking of the same. Now, in broader terms, this lecture has been, intended to sort of reconstitute a rather old understanding of the discipline upon which my research is at least distantly founded, philology. And here I want to quote something that isn't Indic at all to you. I want you to consider what Croce had to say about the 18th century Italian, I've Indianized him, Italian philosopher Vico. By philology, Vico means not only the study of words and their history, but since words are bound up with the idea of things, he means also the history of things. Thus, philologists should deal with war, peace, alliances, travels, commerce, customs, laws and coinage, geography and chronology, and every other subject connected with man's life on earth. Philology, in a word, in Vico's sense, which is also the true sense, embraces not only the history of language or literature, but also that of events, philosophy and politics. The study of narrative and its reception offers a foundation for a renewed focus on this sense of philology as a rich, relevant, and inclusive discipline. It's thus my hope that I've sort of provided a small contribution to this, the ongoing refinement of what is an old approach to philology. After all, as the Mahabharata shows us, apparent sort of conservatism can be a form of revolutionary activity. At least that's what I tell myself as I go to work. So I also hope, returning to my opening conceit of the Mahabharata as an old building, that we've certainly begun to explore some of its kind of great halls and less visited sort of corners. Primarily want to do is convince you that if you weren't already convinced, which I'm sure many of you were because you're here, that the Mahabharata, for its cultural richness, its scale of achievement, its intimacy, its cosmic ambition, its sheer humanity, is a place that you would want to visit again and again and again. And I thank you very much.
Exposition. I like this idea of philology as a humanities, really. Any questions and responses? Mm-hmm.
Your account of the treatment of the Mahabharata in the Urubanga reminded me irresistibly of a rather more recent instance of the use of the Mahabharata David O'Missey's book in Indian Voices of the Great War. It's a translation of the letters of Indian soldiers mainly on the Western Front.
Yeah.
And of course, these people had, joined up from Indian villages to fight the Afghans or something, and found themselves in situations where that they never possibly imagined. And one of the things that they used to understand what was going on was the Mahabharata. You know, so you get I think it helped that that King George V had 5 sons and a daughter.
Yeah.
And also there's pointing out that there were 12 kings at war, which if you work it out is about right, and that they were fighting their cousins. So
yeah. Well, yes, that's certainly true.
Case, you know, and that this was, you know, that it kind of gave them sort of way of, that was what they reached for to understand this. Thing that was happening.
I've seen a few of those letters, and they're lovely. Barca doesn't have so many requests for pickle from home and things like that, they are wonderful. Yeah. Yeah, really wonderful.
But that's what mess is in a way, isn't it? It's what's there that you can use to sort of think with and understand things with.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a good phrase, think with. I think Claude Lévi-Strauss used that to describe myth as good to think with. It certainly is.
Does what you say bear on the old question of why the Mahabharata is felt to be inauspicious to have in the house, whereas the Ramayana is felt to be a good thing in some way?
Yes, I suppose it does. I mean, I such a blood-soaked text does seem to be not the best kind of prenatal reading.
But there's a lot of blood in the Ramayana.
There is, but there perhaps aren't so many... devastating ambivalences in the text. So I'm sure that's a contributory factor. I don't know how widespread. I think it's under a Pradeshi, isn't it? This prohibition, or is it more widespread? I don't know.
I've just sort of seen it referred to occasionally. I think Fitzgerald mentions it in the.
I think it's Rao who...
Sharma Ed volume, but I'm sure I've seen it elsewhere.
Yeah.
I continue to be puzzled as how this document was ever prepared. All of this cross-referencing, we'd almost need a computer to do it. Do we know when, where? How do you think this thing came together?
Okay,
all of the complexity of viewpoints in it.
That's a vexed question in Mahabharata studies, where there's a rather major debate unfolding between some sort of titans of the field over the last few years. But my view on the matter, in short, is that I think that some of this can be as a consequence of multiple redaction. I actually think that the We don't have a critical edition that succeeds in establishing. It leads us to believe that there might have been a singular point of origin, but it also shows us how rich and varied the additions and reworkings of the text were, and that we can't quite know where those begin and end in the critical text as we have it now. So I would, some of its complexity might be as a consequence of that. However, I also suspect that something rather like the text that we have now, though I don't know how like, the earliest material evidence we have is just a Parvan list, which is in the Spitzer manuscript, which is an early Buddhist, it's a Buddhist philosophical text that are primarily in it, but it happens to have this Parvan list that Elie Franco and, well, Dieter Schlingoff looked at first of all, and Elie Franco has now published. That just gives us a list that doesn't include all of the books as we now have it, but does include some of the major didactic works like the Shantiparva. But it doesn't tell us how much of those books was in those books, as we have it. So we know it around the middle of the 3rd century AD that a version of the Mahabharata was circulating, and more than likely before that, obviously. I suspect, in historical terms, the post-Ashoka, Shunga, after we've got the delineation of South Asia as we now have it by conquest, the large scale, you know, a kind of the cultural agenda that's not just Buddhistic but nonetheless quite powerfully controlling, that is reflected in the Ashokan edicts, it seems to me, along, and other people have said this, that the Mahabharata makes a lot of sense as a kind of rejoinder to, in that cultural context, of the just preceding the beginning of the common era amongst the Shungas, or perhaps the Kanwas, who were experimenting with written text, and Witzel, Michael Witzel Sanchez, has written on writing Vedic texts. So that's a cultural context, regionally, culturally, where it might seem sensible and apposite to put together a grand synthetic history of Brahminical culture and the extent of South Asia, and to kind of push it forward and outward. So. Did that, but what?
To the little I know, that's certainly a step forward, but it brings me to another question, which is really one that probably has no basis to it. But since there is so much critique of the thing in there, yet the Brahmanic element hangs it together, is it plausible to think that under one of the major Buddhist kings, that there was the basic patronage? Pull the Brahmins together. Many of the Buddhist dynasties were fairly generous in their supporting of Brahmins, but the Brahmins under those circumstances presumably had to be reasonably attentive to the broader viewpoint of the Buddhist. I've often wondered whether the critical elements in there might reflect some kind of Buddhist royal support for allowing the Brahmins to put this thing together.
Yes, so that's
a good Hindu king. You would expect to be more triumphant.
I think that's quite likely, and also one would expect that if in a cosmopolitan religious environment, yes, that it would seem. I also think these ideas were just sexy and exciting. I think that these new Buddhist and Jain ideas were, I imagine, exerting powerful popular some sort of. I imagine, I believe, but cannot prove. I'm coming back to my. My favoured phrase, that they were crowd pleasers, and as such needed to be integrated in a religious establishment, or even a, we don't know that it was necessarily the dominant religious establishment. I doubt that it was across the whole of North India, and there are recent work that has suggested that perhaps they weren't, but nonetheless it would be sensible to appeal both to kings who were varied in their patterns of patronage, and also to a public that were interested and responsive and receptive to new religious ideologies. They had to move forward. And it's part of a wider pattern, isn't it? I mean, in terms of the kind of portability of the and multi-applicability of Vedic knowledge, you know, it fits into that, the Brihadevata and some of the Atharvavedic stuff that seems to suggest new uses for Vedic mantras, at least, and other material, and even text I don't know well, Rugvedana, which seems to be a real mishmash of materials.
Do you find much explicitly anti-Buddhist elements in there?
Well, no, you don't at all. But there's that's because
that
I
were a good
well, no, I, it's a story about the past. And I think one of the reasons that we always look for missing Buddhists, but it strikes me that this is a tale that in the imagination, it's vastly before Buddhism.
Oh, sure.
So in terms of the fictional universe that is established, that's what I'm trying to get across. And so I often think the puzzling over the lack of this open and explicit engagement is rather odd, because you wouldn't expect to find... but it is there in a veiled way. And one of the things I'm doing next, or I'm in the process of doing in discussion with Valerie, is looking at the context in which we find verses that are shared between Dhammapada and Mahabharata, and their setting in the Mahabharata. And when you look at that, it's quite interesting, because what you do find are some, it seems to be in some of the areas of kind of the most bitterly veiled criticism of Buddhist ideology, right next to these texts that are shared between the Mahabharata and the Dhammapada. That, of course, doesn't mean that they're Dhammapada texts. I mean, the Dhammapada is itself a compilation. But so I think there's much to be learnt and much to be more to be said, but the limitations of the evidence are quite testing. So it tends to devolve, you know, degenerate into I believe but cannot prove. And if one person believes but cannot prove something, we tend to get ding-dongs in the field that are maybe not as productive as they might be. But thank you, yeah, it's interesting.
Now, if you talk about situating it in the past, and that accounts for the absence of Buddhism and Jainism to the extent they are absent, one has to be perhaps a bit careful here, because for us there's a past when before Buddhism and Jainism, but for the Buddhists and Jains there wasn't a past before Buddhism and Jainism.
Yes, yes, but
they've been there episodically forever.
But if you look at, say, how, if you look at how the past is, I see that, but that's part of a triumphalist reconstruction of, an aggressive reconstruction of the past, which would then, if you look at how that takes form and shape and say the Digha Nikaya, just piecing together what is said about the past and
could we call it writing the Buddhists and Jains out of history?
Yes, or rather, I don't know that they're writing out, they're just conveniently picking or constructing an imaginative, yes, to an extent, yes. It's a construction in a sort of imaginative universe in which you don't need to include them because you're telling tales, much as you don't find, you find the, I'd see them, I certainly see the kind of emphasis on, say, the construction of the past that you do find in the Digha Nikaya, and the kind of competitive economy of past life narratives that it seems to suggest, where, you know, a disciple of the Buddha might sort of remark that, well, you haven't really told us much about past lives of X group of people, and then what do you know? The next, I can't give you the references off the top of my head, but it's something I do pick up in my book, right? I do look at the Digha Nikaya in some detail to try and sort of say, well, I think there were, it would be precisely in this type of culture of competing revisionings of the past that one would then see the Mahabharata as a very, it would strengthen my case, not undermine it. Yeah.
Do you think that comparisons with, say, the Greek have anything to tell us about the history and development of the Mahabharata?
It depends at what period you're discussing. It's whether you're discussing the history of, well, in terms of direct Greek cultural contact, I think that's very difficult to reconstruct. Or, I mean, certainly we find mention of India in Greek sources, the geographies and so on. You'd have to, I can't give you the references to those.
Yes.
But there are, and obviously there's the celebrated mention of Roma in the Sabha Parva of the Mahabharata, so Rome at least gets a possible mention. And there's some evidence of, so in terms of cultural contact, I'm not sure. The evidence, I think there is too little evidence to know that there was direct contact in that period. But if we're talking about the oral traditions that fed into the Mahabharata, the kind of smorgasbord of material upon which Brahminical authors must have been drawing in order to construct their new history. And you see that, I mean, all over the Mahabharata, a given minor Vedic character is now with a completely unknown, in a dialogue with Samvada, with an unknown character that doesn't appear anywhere in the Vedas, to kind of espouse some new sort of religious practice, which can be very grand or as minor as the lighting of incense sticks. I mean, that's the pattern of a lot of the didactic material, at least in the Mahabharata. But I'm digressing. My point is that the cultural traditions that fed into the Mahabharata may well, I do not know, and I don't look in that direction, looking into the deeper past, may well have had connections, as you argue yourself, across a large number of works. So, I mean, I wouldn't, and I don't have any, it's a matter of which direction you're looking in.
Yeah.
I'm standing looking forward. If you were standing looking backwards, then it might be apposite and sensible to explore cultural connections. But as from the point of origin of this text, at the beginning of the Common Era, as a kind of radical, as I see it, revisioning of the past and place of South Asia, then I don't see any need to inquire into Greek parallels in that context, but there are other questioning agendas where you might, as you know. Does that answer the question?
Yes, no, I think it's a perfectly fair answer. I mean, I do think that some of the comparisons are quite striking. The one that I tend to use is that the war is structured quite clearly into five phases, the five battle books from Bhishma onwards to Book 10. And in the Greek cycle, the Trojan War is structured into precisely five sections with different leaders of the baddies, or the losers, in the first four, and the final one is the final part is a nocturnal massacre within an enclosure, just as it is in the Mahabharata. And these are sort of massive facts that still don't seem to me to have been quite enough taken account of by Mahabharata people.
Yeah. Well, I haven't. But, I mean, there is this new Spanish work, isn't there, that Alf Hilterbeifel is celebrating, it speaks highly of, that the Greek repertoire, I think it's called the Greek repertoire in India or something. I can't remember what it's actually called.
Yeah, I'm in touch with him by email.
And the other thing I didn't say is just simply the instructive comparison. I mean, one can, and that wouldn't just be Greek material, and you wouldn't need to posit any form of Indo-European connection. It can be instructive to compare literatures.
Yes.
Well, just to look at the cultural conditions of production and dissemination, and to learn from that. So I think there are cogent reasons to compare. It's just not very fashionable, sadly.
Well, thank you very much, James. I was going to ask one last question, actually. Going back to your mongoose at the beginning, which is implicitly critical of the Brahmanical tradition, are there sort of defences of the Brahmanical tradition, as it were, so in the sense that the Buddhism explicitly criticised for the whole thing? You could read as a mongoose criticising the Brahmins.
Well, I think they do a good job of trying to neutralise the mongoose and his threat, but they also are careful to make sure that they state in a sort of that these practices are productive, so they are okay. But one also needs to practice the Vedic sacrifice, which is also okay. There's a wide range of material that celebrates the power and efficacy of an extraordinary range of religious practices that became closely associated with what we now see, as classical Hindu practice. So particularly in the Anushasana Parva, where these very what I call Vedish dialogues occur, where you take a Vedic character, you take a character unknown to the Vedic corpus, like Surabhi or something, the divine cow, and you create a narrative that valorizes a new religious practice, burning of incense sticks, and often these things are lighting of lamps, deepa. There's all sorts of things that are that read very oddly in the Mahabharata at that point. The King Yudhishthira is talking about the power of he's hearing a story about the power of giving a gift of curd, and you're like, I think he can do a bit better than a plate of curd, to be honest. He's King Yudhishthira. So there's all sorts of they're speaking to an audience, and also that material on the vagaries of that's another matter, but there's other areas where it really seems to be reaching out to a context beyond that which was in the anachronisms of especially discourse on foreigners, yavanas and milichas and things like this. There's all sorts of interesting material there that I won't talk about now, but yes. And then the valorization of the text itself, the Palashruti of the Mahabharata are pages long, and really say, this is the thing. You can do a Vedic sacrifice, that's marvellous. You can go on a pilgrimage, but you can read me and all the same outcomes will come to you. This is powerful stuff. So, yes, lots of valorization of lots of different aspects of Brahminical religious practice.
Well, thank you, James, for sharing your work with us. It's been really very interesting. Thank you.